I was hunting for this battle. I wanted to be at war. I wanted to go to the special forces. I wanted to be at war every day. I realized that the war wasn't out there. The war was in here.
You drank too much?
I did.
Because you self-medicate, don't you?
Absolutely.
You don't have a problem with alcohol. You have a problem that's causing you to drink. You can't get to the source of the issue unless you take out the things that are causing the smokescreen. I needed alcohol because I was renting a personality. I started to visualize the person I wanted to be. What does that person look like? What does it feel like to be that person? That repetition on that fixation of who I wanted to be was life-changing. An organization called The Grey Man, going into Southeast Asia, rescuing kids from child prostitution, slavery, and everything else. 1.6 million kids a year sold into that industry in Southeast Asia alone. And here's the thing, by their families. I'm going to go and I'll have some kind of effect in changing the destiny of these kids' lives. I can always remember that we did this briefing. These are the people we've seen. And I saw one guy from the local police who was on the bus get his phone out and go, of all the pictures we had. Next day we went in and did the bust. Ooh, no problem here. There's one particular bust that the picture of went back to our HQ in Australia, and that went viral all over the world. International incident, Thai government, total in defence, saying nothing like that's going on in our country. These guys are a load of crooks. I get a message on my phone saying, get out now.
Ollie, welcome.
Thank you, mate. It's a pleasure to be here. And I'd just like to say for the cameras that I might look like I've just got out of bed, but that is a helmet head.
All right. No, you look good, mate.
A helmet head. So I managed to try and shave. There's no mirror in the bathroom, so obviously designed by men.
New studio.
Yeah.
How are you, mate?
I'm really good.
Yeah?
Really good.
Before we delve in, I mean, I did a bit of research last night again, just looking at it. The resume is insane here. All the things you've done, all the things you carry on to do. But before we delve into that, I think I want to just take it back a little bit to the early years. Childhood, upbringing, relationship with parents, because anyone that's done any kind of inward work, which I know you've done a lot of, and self-development, knows that a lot of our kind of traits as an adult come from those periods of our lives.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I say this because I do a lot of talks. It's my passion, actually. And I do a lot of talks for businesses and stuff. And I always say with that, I said, my life started at 10. And people think, what does he mean by that? What I mean by that is my first memory of life on this planet. And that's because the thing that happened to me was so traumatic that I can't remember beyond that point. And a lot of people know the story, but for those that don't, you know, I went to a circus. They were setting up in my local town, which was Burton-on-Trent, Staffordshire. And back in 1980, that was exciting. So give me a break.
Showing your age, yeah.
Yeah, I am, mate. I am. I'm quite proud of that. we can talk about that as well. Interesting year this was, 1980 though. and we went to see the first person we saw, and it was one of the circus workers. Come, we have a look around. Yes, lads, help yourself. Found myself in a big top, me and my brother and his best mate, and looking around. Nothing really that exciting. Then as an inquisitive little 10-year-old, I saw a split in the side of the canvas. And I'm like, I was compelled to go there. And I sort of walked away from my brother and his best mate, pulled the canvas to one side. The sun hit me straight in the eyes, blurred my vision. But when it cleared, I saw something in front of me that was far better than the big top. And that was a baby chimp. See, I was infatuated at that age. I won't say in love. It was infatuated with Tarzan. That was like a little piece of Hollywood for me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? That was like, I was brought up with cats and dogs, but there's a chimp in front of me. And I'm like, oh, that's amazing. Look at that. And obviously I was cautious, but made my way to it. Before I knew it, I stood over it, not much bigger than it. And it looked up at me with these big, beautiful eyes. And it sounds weird, but we connected. It was like this, time stood still. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. And then the monkey looked down, started picking something from the floor. And I was like, what's that? It started handing me this, whatever it was. Anyway, it was food. And I'm like, holy shit, this thing's now feeding me. I'm like this baby David Attenborough. Yeah. And it's an incredible moment. It's like time stood still. And it was like the serenity of that moment was incredible. And it probably lasted, I don't know, 10, 20 seconds. And it kept, you know, and I was not going to eat it though, because that's disgusting, right? Mm-hmm. So I was sliding it along my cheek. I didn't want to break that moment. Sliding it along my cheek and throwing it over my shoulder. Brilliant. It's getting away with
clever
it.
Clever. The monkey. That.
Well, you know. it was great. This was carrying on. But then that serenity was broken. It was almost like a fighter jet cutting through the skies. I heard a roar that I'll never forget to this day. And that was mummy or daddy in the shadows underneath the trailer that obviously saw me as a major threat to its young. And that those shadows turned very quickly into what was a 50 kilogram chimp. I didn't get a chance to fucking weigh it, but it was big. and it was headed to me at Mach 10. And that was the most horrific thing ever. It was screaming. It was, you know, going mental, showing its teeth, coming at me sideways. And I couldn't move.
I froze.
My feet were stuck to the floor. But just at the moment, I plucked up enough courage to think, I'd get out of here. And I started to make that move. This thing pounced through the air. And the blue sky turned to black as this thing pinned me to the floor. It landed on my chest, pinned me to the floor, and then just went mental. The first fist came down on my sternum here, and it knocked everything out of me. I just had nothing left.
Punched.
Like a small smash. Hammer down. And then it knocked everything out of me. I had nothing. But then it just came down. It was like a drummer in a rock band, and I was the drum. And it was going mental. Wow. And then it started. I could feel meat being, you know, pulled off my arm. And it was in that moment that I started seeing blood flying around everywhere. It was my blood, obviously, not the chimp's. And my life flashed in front of me. It didn't take long. I was 10. But in that moment, deep inside of me, something said, because I thought I was dying, something said, it doesn't end like that. It doesn't end today. And I went somewhere that I never knew that a strength that I never knew I had. And I went into found this strength, this inner potential, this something that helped me then retaliate against a chimp. You know, 10 years old, fighting a grown chimp. I mean, it's not the best situation, is it?
No.
But it was that. It
sounds surreal.
It was that inner strength, that finding that potential that helped me survive the situation. It allowed me to move enough just so I could get my knee up to my chest. I smashed out as hard as I could into the chimp's chest, knocked it to the floor, and then that was my moment to get away. And it was like a few seconds. I was going backwards like an upside down spider, you know, erratic, trying to get away. And then I just stopped, and I was waiting for my fate to happen, because this thing was angrier, even more motivated to kill me than ever. And it came at me for the final attack, and it was a nose, you know, an inch away from my nose when the chain caught it around the neck. And if it wasn't for that chain, if it wasn't for the inner potential in that chain, I wouldn't be here today.
Close call.
It was a close call. And I learned a lot in that moment. I learned the fact that regardless of the situation we find ourselves in, we always have a choice. That was the first thing. The second thing was, this was why my business, this is why everything's called Breakpoint, because of that moment. And Breakpoint, which is my business, which I'm passionate about, which started, well, you know, the concept of started before the TV show and everything else. Breakpoint is the moment you step into short-term discomfort for long-term gain. It's the only way you can achieve anything in life. You know, we have to, if we want to get rid of negative habits, we want to achieve something great in life, we've got to understand that we're going to embrace a level of discomfort. And this, unfortunately, is what people can't face, and they go back to the repeat habit loop and nothing. So that taught me that. But I wouldn't say most importantly, but it did teach me, the third thing it taught me was that inner potential. And it was that inner potential that I learned at that moment as a young kid that I believe helped me not only get through Special Forces selection twice, that's a story in itself, but then helped me further later on down the track when I had major mental health problems, suicidal thoughts, everything else. It was that inner potential, knowing that I could find that extra level of strength, that extra level of that something else. And it was such a valuable lesson to me. But, you know, there's positives and negatives to any situation, and it would also create in me a war. You know, and it's great looking back now. It's great in reflection, isn't it?
But hindsight is beautiful.
Hindsight never won any wars, though. and it's amazing. So that was my first introduction to life on this planet.
You're 10 years old. Hell of a trauma to go through at 10 years old. Now, I presume that trauma, I mean, you've got physical scars,
yeah,
on your arm, but I presume the mental scars of that have stuck with you for many years, right? After being 10.
Yeah, and this is the problem. This is the problem, right? I believe that we have this innate system, this self-preservation system that helps us get over the short-term trauma by pushing it away as far as possible.
Like compartmentalizing.
Yeah. So that really deep emotional trauma, we manage to put it in a little box, lock the key, or lock the box and push it away. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's valuable to help us get over the short term. You can't leave it hidden. And you can't believe that you've got away with it because it's going to come back. And it comes back in all shapes, sizes, and forms. Like later on in life, I can remember my life after that was pretty crazy. I mean, I came from, I'd say, a fairly wealthy family, and I was very different than my brother and sister. I was the youngest, and I was chasing danger. I got in a lot of trouble with the police. I had a sawn-off shotgun at one stage at 14 years old, even took the thing to school and hid it in my locker. You know, it was just it was a recipe waiting for disaster. It never went that far, but, you know, I didn't cause any harm to anyone else. But, it was just this crazy, this war inside of me, you know, this like craziness that I just wanted to push the envelope. And the fact of the matter there is, I believe it was from that experience that created that. And that would, like, throughout all of my life, again, looking back, I have, like, this is how I look at it, right? And I'm jumping ahead of myself here because I've only just come up with this. And I started to think, up until not too long ago, like 6-7 years ago, just before SAS started, I locked myself in a house for 3 months. And we can talk about that. But I locked myself in a house for 3 months because I had to change me. The me that I knew was, I wasn't getting anywhere in life. I was on this destructive path, this repeat habit loop of absolute destruction. Everything good that I did in life, it would be so good, I would then look at it and go, right, hand grenade. I wanted to blow everything up. Relationships, even my time in the special forces, I ruined it. Absolutely ruined it. Everything good I did, I would make sure that I threw that hand grenade in afterwards just to cause a level of chaos. And I look back now, and I look back at that event, right? 10 years old, I'm going down to the happiest thing ever. I'm going down to the swimming pool. First of all, I was going swimming on that day. We saw the big top. Amazing. I was so excited. I was so elated. I then saw this chimp, even more elated, over the moon to see this chimp. And then chaos. Bang, smash. You imagine that. Amazing joy and everything. Then all of a sudden, chaos. And when I look at it from 10... that's what I created in every aspect of my life.
And all of that, you think, comes from the trauma with the chimp?
Yeah, I 100% believe so. The thing is with that trauma, this is where people get it wrong. First of all, people are fighting to be the person they were before the trauma. You're not that person anymore. And the more you fight to be the person you are, the more frustrated and confused you become. You lose direction, you lose purpose and everything. So really, and this is not a word that any human likes, especially not one from the special forces, but you have to surrender. You have to surrender to the new person that you're confronted with.
Wow. But you sound very spiritual.
I am spiritual. You know, I've come up with a thing for this.
But it's quite rare to hear someone, and I'm going to box you a little bit here.
You don't expect it from someone from my...
Yeah. From your background, because obviously I hang around with a lot of the ex-lads as well. I'm friends of all the lads, you know, from Food Duck, whatever. And they've all got a mindset, very positive mindset, very progressive, like they're willing to learn and self-develop. But I don't normally see a real spiritual side to them.
No,
their EQ is very high.
Yeah.
Emotionally very intelligent.
But this is the problem with humanity.
That surrendering piece.
The whole spirituality thing is something that we've been programmed to not engage with because it doesn't allow us to understand the true power of who we are. Now, I've come up with this thing. I'm thinking it's really clever. Only last week. But I've been thinking, because everything that I look into, I need to have it backed by science. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to... So I need to say...
You're rational. Like,
I need to say, right, this happens because of this, and that's science. You know, so basically, science-backed spirituality, SBS.
I like that.
It is, though, but it's science-backed spirituality. And I follow a lot that... Two people in particular... that really captured my attention at the moment. There's a guy called Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Yes.
Who he, you know, to tell him that, oh, that's a load of woo-woo, when he's like got absolute science that backs spirituality. Also, Dr. Bruce Lipton. These
two, I don't
know
if I've heard of that.
Amazing. Get on to listening to him. And they will tell you, you know, this stuff is backed by science. You know, and this is the truth. This is the source code of who we are. And this, we've been misguided, miseducated. And this is why people lack so much self-worth and self-belief. This is it. And this is, you know, as well, this is why, you know what? Because I've always thought, why do people, like off the TV and stuff like that, why do they get so idolized? Now, I know as lads, we've got a bit of a history beyond the TV. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, the TV hasn't defined who we are, but it certainly puts to the forefront. But I've always thought, why do people like idolize like gods these people off the TV? And I 100% believe because they lack self-worth in themselves. They lack self-belief in themselves. And they can't, they that's why they idolize someone in front of them, you know, and really.
They're living through them, aren't they?
But really, you know, and this goes into also the fact, like, you know, a lot of people say, I've heard it said to us a lot of times, oh, you guys are cut from a different cloth. And I won't accept that. I don't accept that at all because I bleed and breathe exactly like everyone else. I don't believe we're cut from a different cloth, but I do believe we found a different way to cut the cloth.
I like that.
You know what I mean? But this is it. And everyone has that potential, but we offload our potential by saying, oh, isn't that person great? Oh, look at him. That's what he does. You know, like Michael Jordan, look how good he is, or anyone of that realm. Isn't that brilliant? They've got the potential.
It's that whole piece of, but they're different. They can do it. I can't do it.
Hmm.
When you're sat on your sofa.
He gives them an excuse, not, you know, well, that's what they do and they're brilliant.
You know what I found really interesting? The fact that you've put spirituality with science. I've never actually heard that.
Yeah.
They don't interlock.
Yeah.
And just from my experience of it. And the reason why is, a lot of the stuff I've spoken to friends that are really into that kind of scene and whether it's psychedelics and whatever, stuff just is. Mm. You can't always answer stuff. Whereas with science, you need an answer for everything.
Yeah.
I'm a rational thinker, right? If I said to you, I'm going to drop this pen and it's going to hit the ceiling.
Yeah.
My brain can't work its head around, get around it because it's going to hit the floor.
Yeah.
That's why science is like, this has happened because of this. But spirituality, I feel like it just is. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just is. And it's an interesting concept that you're bringing them together.
Yeah. No, it is.
But
I think it's important because any naysayers and people that don't believe, if you go, well, how about this information here that is scientifically proven? And that's what I want to be able to do. I want to be able to talk about spirituality in such a way that even the people that have all their life would disregard that and say it's a load of woo-woo and blah, 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 this, that, and the other. I want them to then go, hold on. Let me just look at that a second.
This kind of spirituality thing that you're on now, I'm guessing this wasn't always the case, right? Because it must be very difficult to do the job you did prior when you have a conscious like you have now.
Yeah, 100%.
To an extent.
But this was the thing for me. I feel like I feel like in life you are given a set. There's like a purpose. You've got your purpose in life. Let's talk about the special forces, because when I first, 1980... same year I got bit by the chimp, is the same year that the SAS stormed the Iranian embassy in London. Mm-hmm. Mental image in my head, as soon as I saw that on TV, I was like, oh my God, that was the seed. So I then grew
no
up.
One in your family's been in the military, right?
Yeah, my granddad was in the military.
Okay, so there's a little bit in there.
But
okay.
It was really that seed that when I saw that, I was like, oh my God. It was just like, I had to... Although I didn't think I can be one of those guys, I thought, you know, that was my military sort of DNA started to be stimulated. And that for me, you know, like at 14, that's quite a solid decision. My son's 21, 22, and he still doesn't know what he really wants to do. You know, it's like 14 to go, right, I'm joining the military. That is like a solid decision at that age. And so for me, from 14, I am stimulating all these visions, this perception of what life will be like in the military. And then all of a sudden I achieved my dream by getting in the Royal Marines. I achieved my dream by passing the Royal Marines training.
18 years old, it says.
18 years old. Yeah, I tried at 16, but they said, look, because you've got criminal convictions, you should come back in a couple of years. Otherwise you've got to. Yeah, it's written off. So we followed.
What was a criminal conviction for?
Well, I had a sawn-off shotgun.
Oh, okay. You got caught with that.
I acquired a sawn-off shotgun.
Did you go to prison for that?
No. I went on
rant. It was weak in those days, wasn't it?
Mate, if you did that these days, I'm telling you, it'd be a different story, I'm sure. But yeah, for me, it was like I was sure that I was going to do a custodial sentence. There was more going on than that. I was like, I was nicking stuff and I was just doing everything. I didn't need to nick stuff, you know, but I was just pushing the boat. Pushing
just
the envelope.
To rewind it back a little bit, mate. Like what? So you've had quite a kind of not wealthy but comfortable upbringing.
Mm.
Good relationship with mum and dad, ish.
Yeah.
Till 10 years old.
Yeah.
This thing happens at 10 years old, and then you kind of lose yourself, and you become this kind of naughty kid. Mm. Your brother and sister aren't naughty.
No.
So obviously, some of the trauma from that event has created this person within you. What kind of strain does that put on relationship with mum and dad?
Well,
at the end of the day, now is kind of this. Yeah.
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, it's like whether, you know, I've always held a bit of guilt around that because my mum and dad split up. Now, I know if I said that to my mum, she said, no, 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 it's not you. It was your father. It would have happened anyway. But, you know, that happened just after that, around the time I was getting in trouble and everything else. My mum and dad split up. And it was really, you know, I had a strange relationship with my dad. I was more like an employee than a son. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like
transactional.
Yeah, and I kind of value that in some respects, because what I mean by that is like we were so disciplined, like jobs. We had like a list of jobs as long as your arm, you know, as a kid. I didn't feel we were allowed to be kids as such. Even Saturday mornings were consumed with like making fires, chopping logs, da da da. It was constant. It was constant. Even friends I'd like see friends at school on the Monday and they'd be like, oh, I came around your house on Saturday. I'm like, what? And they'd come round, see my dad. And there was even one friend that came around and says, oh, is Ollie coming out? And you're like, oh, no. And apparently what my dad had got him to do, this friend that had come around to see if I was coming out to play, he got him chopping logs for him. I didn't even see him. I saw him on the Monday at school. He says, your dad had me chopping logs and then said that you weren't coming out. So you know what I mean? It was it was like regimented. It was like, it wasn't in the military or anything, but it was like so disciplined. And I kind of... That has given me some good value.
Of course. Probably explains the 14-year-old decision-making.
Yeah, decision-making. And also the fact now, I mean, I love the way I do things now. I've got everything for me is in order and everything, you know, I have to do stuff when it comes in and not push it to the side and the do it later list and all that. It has to be done. Everything is very disciplined and everything else. So I love that. However, anyway, yeah, I was going to go on a tangent then because it was funny because when I actually got into the military, I think I was so... programmed and pushed like that by my father that as soon as I was away from my father, I rebelled against anything that showed a level of discipline. I was a pain in the arse in the military. Right. Everyone knows that. I was a good soldier. I was one of the best shots. I was one of the best swimmers, but I was a pain in the arse. You know what I mean? It was like I would go out on the piss and like disappear for a couple
just
of
reckless
days.
I was
horrendous, mate. Horrendous
to
manage.
Did they kick you out for that shit though normally?
No, not back. Not whether you would now, but I mean, it was, I wouldn't say harmless. It got to the point with me where they were like, for fuck's sake, you know, they just kind of had enough of it. And then at that point, I'd had enough. I think if I'd have stayed any longer, I would have been kicked out because I was just, you know, it just wasn't the way to operate. And I really look back. And going back to your question though, Ty, it's like I went into the military with this dream. I like got through the Royal Marines training and everything else. And it was like this dream of mine. Got up to... like 4-5 commando up in Scotland and went, this is shit. You know what I mean? I got a brochure and there was like some lad who was on leave. His blonde chick is on the beach. She's beautiful. He's on a surfboard, like, you know, in the Bahamas or somewhere. You know what I mean? It's like, and I get up to 4-5 commando. I'm like on the main gate on Christmas Eve. You know what I mean? Doing guard duty.
Cold.
And I'm like, and this is shit. This was not in the brochure. Then I went out to Northern Ireland and realized that, you know, they call it, whatever, but when people are shooting at me, I call it a war, but I grew up very quickly in Northern Ireland and realized it's a very different thing that I was joining. And that's the thing that pushed me for Special Forces because I went, right, it's not here. I need to go and find what I'm looking for because it's obviously in the Special Forces. Mm-hmm. But then I got through to the Special Forces and then it was the same for me there. But the thing is, I did not understand the meaning of purpose at that age as a kid. I didn't even have that in my vocabulary. So I started self-reflecting on me and going, there's something wrong with you. And really for me, that's so much confusion in here. The only thing I knew what to do really is just drink, 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 stop the chatting, stop the noise up here, stop everything. Just use, you know, just
numb.
Just numb yourself. Numb it out. And that's what I constantly did.
Mate, let's talk about, I'm just going to take it back a little bit and then we'll carry on. But this trauma from the chimp thing, right? Mm. I did a bit of research and you actually ended up doing ayahuasca, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Talk to me about that.
I'll tell you what, this is the interesting story. I think it's really good that we talk about this because this again is with trauma, right? Now, something happened before the ayahuasca experience, something that when you need, there's unfinished business with the chimp.
Okay.
And that was one of the guys that I joined up in training when I was 18, a lad called Troy. He was my best mate through training and everything else. Anyway, mates all throughout our careers in the military. I went off to the Special Forces. He didn't. Anyway, I'd left. Troy was still in. And I think it was about 2011 or something like that. or maybe a little bit earlier, around 2011. I came back to the UK, said, I'm coming back. He said, meet me in the pub. I haven't seen you for ages. It'd be great to catch up. Anyway, I sat down with him in the pub and he said to me, mate, something really weird happened. I went, what? I thought, shit, what have I done now? And he said, I was out in Afghan. And he was like, he was a color sergeant, quite high up generally. And he was trying to get vehicles for his lads. You know, a lot of the vehicles have been blown up. They didn't really have the vehicles to be able to carry out operations. So he was constantly getting in touch with the MTO, the military transport officer at in Afghan. Every time I sent an email, it was like, no, you can't have them. It's the same protocol for everyone. No one's getting vehicles. We just haven't got them, blah, blah, blah. So he, in the end, he got bored of the email system and he went to his office, managed to get snuggle through the MPs and everything, got into this officer's office and he's like, sir, I've been sending you emails about the vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. And he's like, how did you get in here? Get out, I'm going to get you arrested, blah, blah, blah. And he says, sir, I need the vehicles. You can't have them, get out. Anyway, he's making his way out. And obviously the Royal Marines is quite a small element in the military. He's just going out the door and he says, before you go, he said, do you know a lad called Ollie Ollerton? And he stops in his tracks in Northern Manchester and goes, fucking hell, do I know Ollie? And he says, yeah, he says, I joined up with him. I've been, you know, he's one of my best mates. Da, da, da. Then he went off to the special forces and da, da, da. He says, so why are you asking about Ollie? He says, you know what? He says, I've been looking for that boy all of my career. I was with him when he got bit by a chimp when he was 10 years old.
No.
Fact.
So who was that guy then? Your brother?
He was my brother's best mate, James.
Wow.
So anyway.
What a full circle.
Troy is like, oh my God, you're kidding me. Anyway, they have a great conversation, da, 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 this, that, and the other. Can't believe it, Drew. Went to shake his hand to leave, and the guy pulls him in. James pulls him in and says, where do you want those vehicles? Wow. Got the vehicles for all the lads. Through that circle. When he told me that, and it just did happen to me just then, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up and I went, what is this? What is this? And this is what a lot of people do, right? We don't analyze the situations we call coincidence. I don't believe in coincidence. And that to
me, it's
a universe. That had done a complete circle. And to me, that was a tap on the shoulder saying, there's unfinished business, mate.
Wow.
So then shortly after that, things started lining up.
That real re-trigger a lot of stuff, I guess.
Yeah, it did. It brought it back to the top. You know, it brought it back and I was like starting to be like, starting to really
amplify it as well.
Amplify it, yeah. And I really think this is the truth, right? Opportunities, goals, achievements, everything, they don't line up for you. It's you have to line up and then they show themselves. Once you get in a good space, you know, for me, I'd stop drinking and this, that, and the other, and, you know, which was a massive achievement for me. And I really start to invest in myself, you know, the best investment you can make. And when I really start to, everything started working out. It's just incredible. You know, the TV thing happened, did this, and it was just incredible. But for me, it was like, then all of a sudden, like an ex-girlfriend of mine, I was over Australia, I moved to Australia with her, but luckily she was a psychologist, which saved me a fortune, but that's by the by. but she had told me, you know, I came back to the UK 2014. She told me she'd started looking into this ayahuasca.
Plant medicine, yeah.
Yeah, she said, I think you could get so much. She obviously knew me when I was working in Iraq as a contractor, absolute mayhem. And she said, I really think you could get a lot from this. So anyway, it was that seed was like in there. And then all of a sudden, the universe starts lining up. All of a sudden, you know, I've been looking at stuff on Instagram and I've been looking at ayahuasca and this, and I found this thing called Heroic Hearts Project in the US. And I started liking some of their stuff, you know, about ayahuasca and how it's helping veterans and everything. Next thing, I get a message from the guy that owns or started that company or that project. And he says, hey, mate, you know, this is shortly afterwards. Hey, mate, I'm in London in a couple of weeks. Would you like to meet up? Because we've got a retreat coming up. I wonder if you'd like to be part of it. And I was like,
fuck, it's all aligned.
Yeah, it's all lining up. And that's another thing for me. You know, a lot of people, when those things happen, they go, oh, coincidence. Oh, that's weird. It's not weird. This is not weird. This is how things line up. It's a sign. It's the universe talking to you. It's lining things up for you. Anyway, cut a long story short, I'm like sitting there thinking, well, I'm good now. You know, a lot of people, it was for veterans, I'm thinking, I don't have any problems. You know what I mean? I'm good. My life's great. I'm making money, this, that, and the other. I've done a couple of books, you know, life's great. What do I really want to deal with? But then I'd heard people that done ayahuasca, like people in business, that it's just opened, expanded their mind and allowed them to be a lot better you know, in everything they do. So I thought, I'm going to go anyway. So I went along, and there was about 14 other veterans there. Went to a place called Soltara in Costa Rica.
Okay.
Amazing venue. And that's one thing I was saying about ayahuasca.
Well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got to, don't do it in some back street in Manchester or, you know what I mean?
You've got I thought you were going to say in London.
Yeah,
that's
what I was thinking. No, it was, you know, we went over there. Amazing facility. And they know what they're doing. You know what I mean? They know how to guide you on that journey. And for me, I went there and it was like, I met all the other, and there was people with a lot of problems. I'm talking veterans that had been to Afghan, you know, that horrific, horrific stuff, trauma they were dealing with. So anyway, you go in, you see the shaman, and you have to say what your intentions are. So it was my turn. I had a chat with him and I said, look, and my thing, I had to kind of make it up. I was like, because I knew it never happened. I'm like, I'm a little bit scared that one day I will, if something major happens in my life, I will push that self-destruct button again. Mm-hmm. And that's when my, you know, I've done that so many times in the past. So I said that, and then I said, and also there was this little thing with a chimp when, you know, when I was a kid, I got attacked by it. I kind of brushed it off and he went, oh, okay, okay. Now, one thing with ayahuasca, it goes to where it's needed, not where you want.
So that's you can,
exactly. Is that what's keeping you back?
Yeah.
But the thing is, that's exactly, you can go in there with your intentions, and you should have an intention of why you want to go there and what you want to do and where you want it to go, but it will go to where it's needed. So I went in, and the first night we took the ayahuasca, it was kind of a test. They test it first to make sure the measures, see how you, what your tolerance is like.
What, like a little bit of it?
Yeah, and a small amount of it. So it's a hallucinogenic.
Does it still give you anything, that small
dose? Well, that was the thing for me. It didn't really kick in.
Okay.
With me, some people had, you know, I've done hallucinogenics in my, so I knew kind of what to expect, but it wasn't, I could feel a little edge, and I just thought, this is, maybe it's me, maybe it's not going to work. So we had a debrief the next day, talked about it. I just, it's all right. I didn't really get much. Next night, they upped the dose. Fuck me. And, mate, honestly, it was incredible.
I'm so interested.
It was incredible. And you were in this maloka. So it's like, imagine a massive version of this round table.
Yeah.
A maloka. You've got beds all the way around. You've got the shaman that sits in the middle. And you're in the jungle. You know, you can hear the jungle. The jungle's alive. And you are part of nature. It's just incredible. So you sit there. You go into the middle. You go and get your medicine. Glass, very similar to that. And you whack the thing back, the medicine back. Anyway, you go back and you sit on your
Does it taste like shit?
I mean, it's not something that you'd... Yeah. You know what I mean? Mate, I used to have tuna smoothies, so even for me...
Sophia was lovely.
Yeah, to get protein into me. I used to have tuna smoothies when I was in Iraq. But so anything... Anyway, it was good, but... So anyway, I sat back down, and then they've got... You know, everything's going on. Everyone's doing their bit, mate. And then all of a sudden, all the geometry... You start seeing all this geometry and all these light, and you go into this different realm. It is, you can still hear everything that's going on.
Okay.
But you are in your journey, and it's incredible. And then basically I was like, having to breathe, 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 breathe. And one thing again, this comes back again, right? Again, not a good word for anyone from my background or anyone in general. You have to surrender to it. The more you fight against it and you try and fight against it, you know, you'll cause mayhem. And you just have to surrender and allow it to do its work. That for me was like, it was going down this, it was almost like I had these, all these different doorways to go down. Hmm. You know, I could choose a different doorway and each one would give me a different aspect of my life. You know, there's so many things I could address. But then I went past the doorway and it was the one. So I went into this doorway. And then, mate, it was like I knew where I was going. And it was almost like I was like, my nails were on the wall, like a chalkboard going down. I was going, no, 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 because I knew I was going back to the circus. And I could see me at the end of this room, of this corridor. And I was like, no, no, I don't want to go there. Because I knew what was down there. Anyway, went down. And I actually then, went, I became the boy. And I'm there at the circus, like... You're actually there. You're in the dimension. You're there. It's crazy. And I'm like, yeah, this is great. The baby chimp was in front of me. And then that roar, the roar I heard, the roar that I know happened. And then all of a sudden I look in the background and I'm absolutely terrified. And then something really weird happened. it almost just stopped because I could make out there was something moving in the underneath the trailer. But then something really weird happened. I went from being the boy to being the chimp. And when I say that, it was so real that because I'd been lying down up until the point I came to the to my baby here, I'd been lying down in the sun. It was a hot day. When I got up as the chimp, I could feel the leaves falling off my back. I could feel all the hair on me as a chimp.
Wow!
And I became the chimp, and I was looking at me over my young. And honestly, then like you see on Terminator, you see the readout. Mm-hmm. I had the readout going threat, and it was pointing at me. Threat, like red readout, this computer screen readout. It's crazy. And I was getting ready to, I was getting angry. I was getting ready. And honestly, I'd gone from my mattress where I was, and I was like a chimp, you know, with my mm-hmm. fist in the floor, and I was roaring like a chimp, like on the day, exactly the same as on the day. Then I thought, you know, that I thought I was about to attack. Then I went back into the boy. I'm like, it again stopped. And straight away, I started to feel compassion for the chimp. I took my, all the time I told that story, I was the victim. All the time, it was me, and poor me, and me, this happened to me, it was all about me. For the first time ever, I took myself out of being the victim and I became something bigger. I was part of that. It didn't come looking for me. I went into somewhere I wasn't supposed to be.
Of course.
And then I started to feel so much compassion for that chimp. The fact that it would do anything to protect its young, it would sacrifice its own well-being, you know, its own physical well-being to protect its young. And then that whole compassion piece, I started then to think on every aspect in my life, all the pressure I put on my wife, who's got a son, who's now my stepson. You know, I put pressure on my wife, you know, to do stuff with the business and this, that, and the other. And it made me realize that there's nothing more important to her, whether she would say it or not, than her son. So the whole lesson with that was compassion. It was just this, it was compassion, just so much compassion, and taking us out of being the victim. 90% of people on this planet are actually embracing being the victim. And it's not, we are creators. We're not victims. Mm-hmm. And it's such an important lesson. So that happened. Anyway, that kind of ended. I came out of that and it was like, whew. I had the debrief the next day. Then I think, right, I've saw me and the chimp are good. You know what I mean? It's all good. Great. I wonder what's tonight. And so the next night we went in, I said, give me more. I want more. So I went in, you know, just later on, we had the debrief and everything. Give me more. And when we did the debrief, everyone was saying, Jesus, you were like this crazy animal. I said, I know I was.
So you were physically moving as well in the room.
Like, I was in that
not
room.
Not just laying mentally.
I was on there. I was roaring at the top of my voice. And I was like sat like a chimp with my fists in the floor in front of me, like just roaring like a chimp. Like, it was mental. They said, yeah, you were like, you were the animal.
Fuck.
I said, I know I was. So, and then the next night we did, the same thing happened. And I'm like, I've dealt with the chimp. I've dealt with you. I don't need to go back down here. I'm scratching down the walls again. It was like, I went back. I went into the boy. And then the thing that I really didn't want to happen happened. And the whole thing played out. I got attacked. And I went through that physical event that happened for me at 10 years old. In my head, since that 10-year-old, because I'd locked away that intimate trauma, there was no noise. Mm-hmm. That sounds weird, but there was no noise around it. So every time I reflected back on it, there was no emotional attachment to it. There was no noise. There was no nothing. For the first time ever, I felt every emotion of that attack. I was petrified. I was screaming for my mum. It was horrible, absolutely horrible. Then all of a sudden it stopped again. And something said to me, what would have happened if you hadn't retaliated? And I stopped anyway. And then I just stopped, didn't retaliate. And I lay down. And I can remember I lay down. And I opened my eyes and looking at me straight into my eyes is my wife, her blue eyes. And I said to her, don't be scared. Don't worry. Just come with me. And I died. I died and went into the spirit world. I was no longer a physical presence. I was spirit. And it was incredible. It was just the best thing ever. Like the noises, everything. I was no longer a physical body. It was just part of this amazing place. I didn't want to come back.
Quite an emotional bit, that.
Yeah, it was. You know, I didn't even, when we went in there, I didn't actually, you know, I couldn't then look at my wife. We weren't physical anymore. Mm. It was just like we were, I don't know, just part of this. And I didn't want to come back. And then I heard a voice saying, people need you. So I came back into me as a physical body. And I can remember that moment, mate. I then woke up from that and I was like, I went to the shame and I said, I've seen it. I know what this life is all about. I've seen it. And, you know, it was like an epiphany for me. It was incredible. And I came out of there and then we had another one the next night, which is really, they call it the landing, where they bring you down slightly smaller dose and they allow the plane to land, if that makes any sense. And that was a massive, for me, it was some incredible lessons. You know, and when I got back after that night, I was like scrolling on my pad, like mental, mate. It was like crazy. And there's a couple of things I came up with, and I don't know why I came up with this first one, but it was like, just because you can say sorry doesn't mean you can do it anyway. And secondly, pain screams the loudest when it's dying. And that to me means so much in everything. Yeah, because it does. Whenever you want to change, look as a typical example of a relationship, it screams the loudest when it's really falling apart. And you have to understand that that may be the death of something, but it's the birth of something new. And it's the birth of something new that you should reflect on and not try and put a Band-Aid on, which is the obvious thing to do, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But that's the same with everything in your life, anything you're trying to let go of. And this would, you know, that when I reflected back on my life, there were so many incidents where this had happened, where you think, oh my God, my life is falling apart. And you've got to sometimes allow that to happen and understand without that falling apart, you are never going to have that something new, the birth of something new. Mm-hmm. It was an incredible moment for me. But the thing is, you come back to society and then you get all that goodness gets diluted again.
I have friends that, one of them that does it kind of every sort of 3 to 5 years, he goes and does it again. He's done it like 14 times because he said exactly what you just said. He said, you come back to the real world.
Yeah.
And after a while, it fucking chips away at you, chips away at you, chips away. Yeah. And you feel it building up again. And he goes again. Have you not been again?
No. And
how many years ago was this, by the way?
This was back in 2019.
Okay. So nearly 4 years or four years. And these last 4 years, are you at peace with that chimp now?
I am. I do believe
genuinely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. 100%. You know what? This sounds weird. I know it sounds weird. And I don't regret anything in my life. But I actually, I'm so glad that happened to me at 10. And I know that, I didn't want it to happen at the time. But, you know, looking back, it's so many life lessons from that. Mm. And it really did create the person I am today. And, you know, for me, that was what I had to resolve with that, you know, and that was the thing for me is like, I then just reflecting back and understanding there's good and bad with every situation. That did help me find that inner motivation, that inner power, which helped me get through the special forces and everything else and blah, 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 and mental health issues. But, you know, the negative side of it was the fact that I would find whenever I did well in life, I would then blow it up.
Yeah.
Relationships and everything. And really, you know, the thing for me was like, I was hunting for this battle. I wanted to be at war. I wanted to be at war. I wanted to go to the special forces. I wanted to be at war every day. It's only later after leaving the special forces, sometime later, I realized that the war wasn't out there. The war was in here. Mm-hmm. And that's what I needed to resolve, not the external. And this is where we all get it wrong because we believe happiness, success, everything is external. And it's not. You cannot change the energy or you cannot change the environment, your environment, until you change the energy of who you are. Mm-hmm. You know, you might go, let's say for a business, for instance, you might go and get a loan from the bank and say, right, I'm going to buy this, I'm going to do that, da-da, and that's going to change. And you'll get that honeymoon period for a little bit where it's all happened. But before you know it, your subconscious behaviors will then start to take over and you'll be back to square one. Mm-hmm. You'll be just dragging your shit with you and then you'll be back to square one. So you can't change anything until you change the energy of who you are. And I think this is so important that people start to realize that. 95% of our habits and behaviors by the time we're 30, a repeat pattern of yesterday. Only 5% of our minds are creative, allows us to be creative. There's only 5%. So 95% is just a repeat of yesterday. And this is why I talk about, you know, spirituality backed by science and everything else. You know, when we start to understand that that is just our survival instinct, I say this right in all of my talks to everyone, and people need to understand their primal coding. There's nothing more important to us, each and every person on this planet, than our desire for survival. Mm-hmm. Not how many followers we've got on Egogram.
Very true.
Not the house we've got, not the husband we've got, not the wife we've got, not the car we've got. That is our desire for survival is the strongest subconscious behavior. This is like when you're born, that's like buying a computer with default software on it. Mm. Mm-hmm. That's your program. Now, before I go on to that, the first 0 to 7 years is where you're programmed by your environment. And this is why the Jesuits have been teaching their people for 400 years, give me the boy until he is 7 and I will showeth the man. Mm-hmm. Those years are basically this human organism learning its environment so it can adapt and survive in that environment. Now, there's a few things that, unless you're aware of them, this is the program. This is the, if you want to call it the matrix, this is the program, this is everything else. And that is, our minds were programmed for survival, not success. How does that affect who we are? Just to prove that, can you relate to this, right? You go to somewhere, you meet a load of people you've never met before.
Okay.
Shake hands, my name's da 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 da. Then you go out and then you see them again and think, fuck, I don't know what their name is.
I can relate to that. Always. Everyone. Face yes, name no. Yeah.
I'll tell you exactly what's happened and why that happens. And that's the fact that when you know you're meeting someone new that you haven't met before, as soon as you see that person, your mind is going through the thousands of different people you've met throughout your life, through that database and trying to add it to an emotion. When you can't find that picture or the emotion, you're on high alert. That's why names are absolutely irrelevant. It's not important.
That's really interesting.
It's not important. And that's how strong our survival blueprint is. Another thing with that, the fact that the repeat habit loop, and you'll relate to this, everyone relates to it. But our minds, when it comes to survival, want us to do what we did yesterday and the day before that and the day before that and the day before that. Because as far as your survival mind is concerned, it's kept you safe until today. It's familiar. It's safe. It doesn't give a shit if it's a good situation or a bad situation. It just wants to keep you locked in that repeat habit loop. And this is why people don't achieve anything. It gets tough, it gets hard, the mind goes, get back there. You know, and the fact that we're programmed from 0 to 7, when you come up with something new and say, right, I'm going to start this business, I'm going to start this fitness program, I'm going to do this, I'm going to get this new relationship, I'm going to get out of that relationship. Once it's in the frontal cortex, which is only 5% of your thinking power, what happens then is your subconscious gets hold of it and says, let me show you how that's done. Based on the programming you had from 0 to 7.
Preset bias.
That's fact. Yeah, that's fact. So you can come up with whatever you want to come up with, but your subconscious will deal with it in the way it's programmed. If you're told when you're a kid, you're worthless, you're this, you're that, you imagine between 0 and 7, you're on record. Your head's on record. So if you've heard that as a kid, you're useless, you're there, and you know, from your siblings, from your mom, everyone around you, that becomes part of your program. So as soon as you come up with something, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, once it's got over that little honeymoon period, your subconscious will go, can't you remember you're not worthy? Can't you remember you're useless? Can't you? That is the program.
How do we break out of that? And the reason I ask that is, I've had so many guests here, and they all say similar to you. They all say, you know what? I don't regret that happened to me because it made me who I am.
Yeah.
I don't regret that happened to me, made me who I am. So, and that 0 to 7 piece is really important. I'm an ambassador for Dorset Mind, which is a mental health charity, local one. And in our training, we do 2 to 7, but very similar.
Yeah.
2 to 7, you're like a sponge. Mm. But I always, when I first found that out, I was thinking, fucking hell, like how many of my friends' kids are we around when they're 2, 3, 4, and we're talking about stuff, or their parents might be acting a certain way, thinking, he's only little, she's only little.
Yeah.
But they're subliminally being programmed.
They're on record.
But those people who have had that trauma or have had that experience that maybe is not as positive as others, how do we then break out of that habit loop? Because naturally, you're right. I really resonate with that. I keep trying new things and my body keeps bringing me, like I always, if I always run a 5K, my body wants to run a 5K, not do hill sprints.
Yeah.
I get up to hill sprints, but I'll run a 5K.
Yeah, yeah.
Shit analogy, but it just knows I can do it.
That's exactly it.
It knows it's comfortable.
We work within our comfort zone. We work where we know that's familiar. Mm. We avoid stress. We go the path of least resistance. These are all the things that are that survival mind. How'd you get out of it? There's three things that influence the subconscious mind. The first 0 to 7 years, that's your programming. Mm-hmm. The second thing is a highly impactful emotional situation. So if you have something that happens to you, that could be a good thing. It could be the fact you got married. It could be the fact something, you've met the love of your life, whatever it is, but it could also be the bad things. You know, what happens in those highly emotional situations is your brain takes a snapshot and adds that to an emotion. And basically that becomes your long-term memory. So that's the second thing. So first of all, 0 to 7, that's your programming. Mm-hmm. Something of high emotional impact, that's another thing that can influence your subconscious mind. And the last thing, and this is how we reprogram, is repetition. repetition. That's the only way beyond seven that you can then reprogram the subconscious mind. This is why it's like everyone goes like on about Michael Jordan. They go on about Tiger Woods. What do they do constantly?
Practice
a shot in their head before the game. Everything, they've gone through the shot constantly. And everyone goes, isn't it brilliant that they do that? You can do it as well. Mm-hmm. And this is the way that we change the subconscious mind. That for me was a revelation, because I actually understood. This is when I got into that house. This is when I learned all this stuff, when I got into that house, because I was like, how the fuck am I, like, I know what I'm doing wrong. You know, I knew I was going into situations, relationships, work, everything, and just it was good. Well, this is boring. Chaos. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was fueled by alcohol. It was, you know, alcohol was the platform, you know, to really amplify that chaos. Now, I knew, all right, well, it's easy, isn't it? Just stop drinking. The solution is right in front of us, mm-hmm. but doing it, we just can't do it because it's as simple, doesn't make it easy. But really, that's what you have to do, constant repetition. Like 60,000 to 70,000 thoughts a day go through your frontal cortex. You know, loads of stuff. And that's stimulated by 5 senses from the environment around us. The more you think a thought in your frontal cortex, it starts to then impress upon the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind is like the master receiving messages. It's the blind master receiving messages from the frontal cortex. Mm-hmm. So someone that's saying, I'm not worthy. They're told by their friends, they're not you know, this, that, and the other, by their parents, by their partner, I'm not worthy. If they're constantly hearing that message, that then becomes part of the program. It's exactly the same way as when you drive a car. You know, the first time you drove a car, it's like your fucking head's going to explode,
yeah.
isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Can't make sense of anything.
You know what I mean? How am I ever going to do this?
Or a motorbike.
Yeah, or a motorbike.
Even worse.
Absolutely. Or a submarine.
I've not driven one of them, yeah.
But it is. It's absolutely cognitive overload. But you know, after like 6 months, you're driving to your destination. You're like, you've Spotify on. You're on a conversation with your mates. Your hands in a bag of crisps. And you don't even know how you got there. Mm-hmm. Because basically, it's gone from your frontal cortex into the program. It's become part of your subconscious programming. So that repetition is the way that we do it beyond 7 years old.
I'm just thinking of all the things that I need to change.
Yeah, we all do,
and
mate.
What kind of the repetition looks like in that sense.
Yeah, 100%. Everyone can do it.
Mate, you mentioned a lot about booze. You had some struggles with booze, right?
Yeah, I did. I did have some major, you know, from 14, I was brought up in a brewery town and my family was pretty much paid in alcohol. I'm not making that as an excuse, but, you know, for me, you know, when it comes to alcohol, you don't have a problem with alcohol. You have a problem that's causing you to drink.
That's an interesting concept.
You know what I mean? So it's not, forget the drink. You've got a problem that's causing you to drink. The thing is, what's happened when you're younger,
You're
masking something deeper. And that can be as simple as confrontational. You, for me, and I'll tell you now, I've never said this before really, and it's definitely not on a podcast. For me, intimacy with women, fix for that, to get over that, that sort of blockage and confusion was alcohol. So every time, you know, and that's why you can relate to that. You know,
of course,
you go out, you know, you're not going to approach people when you're not drunk.
No.
You know, so that for me, completely. And even that intimacy with it was like, have a drink. So that becomes your solution, but then that becomes
the habit.
Your habit. Do you know what I mean? So for me, every time anything got difficult, it was just like, I just drink. And it got to the point where, you know, I'd started thinking about suicide and stuff like that. And I realized that all these, you know, again, it wasn't I had to get to the source of the issue. You can't get to the source of the issue unless you take out the things that are causing the smokescreen. Alcohol was one of them.
What's got you that dark? What thoughts are going in your head to get that dark, to such a dark place where you're thinking like, I don't want to be here no more?
Well, mate, I just started really regretting. You know, it's like the downs, the come down from alcohol was just, it was disgusting. It makes me shiver now just thinking about some of the things where my mind was at.
And this is before military, right?
Well, this is military. Through the military, it was just accept. I was like, I didn't ever question alcohol.
Got you.
Didn't ever question it. You know, it was like just part, you know, and that became my identity. You know, at the end of the day, I needed alcohol because I was renting the personality. You know what I mean? I wasn't Ollie, the Ollie that everyone knew, unless I was, you know, that party guy, you know, this, that, and the other. And it got to the point where, you know, I think it was 2011, And I went across, I'd just come back from rescuing the kids in Southeast Asia. The best thing I'd ever done to that point.
I'll touch on that in a
bit. Yeah, and the fact was, you know, it came crashing down overnight. And for the first time, I'd found something so amazing. The dots all connected. The first time in my life, you know, everything that was missing in the special forces suddenly came together. The dots all connected. And I went, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. It came crashing down. I came crashing down with it. I did what I always knew to do. And I started hitting, you know, drugs, everything. I was fucking shoving everything up my nose, drinking, and just this destruction, smoking, all things that you would not associate with me doing this day and age. And it was in those low points that I started thinking suicide. And that is the brain looking for the easy way out, because I couldn't see a way out. I hated it. I hated myself. I hated the world around me. And that for me was like, at that point, for the first time in my life, when I went, I heard that voice in my head again that said, it doesn't end like this, Ollie. There's more to your story. And I heard that voice and I was like, luckily I listened. And that was my turning point for me. I didn't stop straight away, but I say to a lot of people, just your awareness of the problem is the first biggest step. And once I did that, I started then to think, what am I doing in this moment? I'm hating the world around me. I'm hating the chimp. I'm hating the military. Hating everyone that's I've been in a relationship. Worst of all, I was hating myself. Hating myself. The more you focus on anything, the bigger it becomes. That is fact. So I thought, what's the opposite of this then? I started to visualize the person I wanted to be. What does that person look like? I came up with an image. Once I come up with the image, added emotion to it. So powerful. What does it feel like to be that person? And that fixation, that repetition on that fixation of who I wanted to be was life-changing.
That's such a strong kind of mental control to be able to do that. You know, in the depths of despair that you can imagine who you want to be and kind of look towards the light, hypothetically speaking.
Yeah. But that was the first time where I sat there, you know, I came back and I was looking for all these external fixes. You know, I was like, I want to start my company called Breakpoint. I was looking for all these external fixes. I need to get a loan. I need to get a credit card. This is the old me, you know, because I've always done this. Looking for everything external. And all of a sudden, all those doors closed and I was left with me. And I went, do I stop? And then I thought, right, no, I'm going to. I'd kind of had a brush with spirituality, with positive thought, visualization on a road to Baghdad. That was an interesting story. Anyway, so I'd kind of had a brush with the power of visualization. So I thought, I'm going to give it a go. I'm going to throw myself into this like you would not believe. And I did that. I locked myself in a house for 3 months, mind, body, and nutrition. No newspapers, no news, no TV, nothing. No social media. I focused on me through those three things, mind, body, and nutrition.
Where was this?
This is a house in Cornwall.
And mate, literally, you on your own?
I'm on my own, yeah. I come back to the UK.
What do you do every day? You get up and do what?
Go up every day. I started investing in me massively. So first of all, I would exercise like 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, I wouldn't exercise first. I'd do things that my peers would still laugh at me for. And people listening to this would probably snigger out, but meditation, visualization, goal setting, listening to positive podcasts. I had this constant routine. I made sure everything I consumed here and here was of the highest quality for who I wanted to be. The correlation between what goes in here and what you think here is something you really need to consider.
Yeah, it's huge.
People put better food in their cars than they do in our bodies. So basically, it was just this constant. And I had this visualization every day. Right, when I was doing my meditations. Meditation for me is my focused attention at my intentions. So between the 60 and 70,000 thoughts, I start to choose the things that I want. I visualize and focus on that. And my visualization every day was me and Foxy were on a stage in front of loads of people delivering these amazing talks. And I put myself there as if I was there, as if I was living it. I felt the shirt on my back, the expensive watch on my arm, the shoes on my feet. I breathed, tasted it.
Love it.
Every day I did that. I also actually came up with this, right, how this business is going to look. We're going to take corporates. We're going to put them through like an SAS experience. We're going to get them to understand who they are from the inside out. This is how it's all going to work. Every day I visualize that. At the end of 3 months, cut a long story short, at the end of 3 months, I started thinking, does this shit work? Maybe it's just a load of shit. And see the self-doubt starts eating away.
Yeah.
And I shouted at the top of my voice in that house, just give me something. I wanted the phone to ring. I wanted something to happen. Nothing happened. 2 days later, Foxy called me and he said, hey, you know that idea you've got for Breakpoint? Would you do that on national TV?
Wow.
And the hairs on the back of my neck, went, they are doing now because I remember that moment. And it was like, are you kidding me? I thought he was down the pub because I was trying not to be. And he said, no, I'm with the production company now. And it's like, I tell everyone that story because the power of visualization, I changed the energy and the vibration of who I was from the person I went in. The person that went into that house would not have got that opportunity, I tell you now.
Hmm.
But the person I became in that process, I lined myself up for that opportunity and it came to me.
It's powerful, right?
So that visualization every day about being on the stage, about doing, you know, Breakpoint, what happened? What am I doing now? Like SAS Who Dares Wins happened and I'm on stage pretty much 2-3 times a week with big companies changing people's lives. I mean, can we turn around and go, oh, that's weird, that's just a coincidence?
I don't think so.
No.
Not listening to you today.
No. Not 100%, mate. And, you know, to anyone that tells me that it's just woo-woo and thinks we're just lumps of meat and gravy that eat, work, sleep and repeat, you are missing out.
Such an interesting concept hearing it from you, mate. Yeah. Genuinely, because like, I don't know, I just... You're an all or nothing kind of guy, aren't you?
I am, mate. I've got a book called All or Nothing. But yeah, I am, mate, 100%.
I'm a bit like that, but that's a bit of a curse.
It is. It
it's not always a blessing, is
blessing
it?
Blessing and a curse, yeah. Mm. Yeah. No, it's not. And this is why, for me, I couldn't find that middle road. You're probably the same, aren't you?
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's like alcohol. I'll be the best alcoholic. I'll be the best party guy ever.
It's interesting because Ant was here a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And he said something very similar.
Yeah.
He will be the best he can be.
Yeah.
And even when I said to him about when you went to prison, what was it like? He goes, mate, I was just the best prisoner there was. I was getting jobs. I was cooking. I was cleaning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just can't. I'll put it into my world, like let's say trying to eat clean.
Mm.
I'm either flat out athlete, training twice a day, eating like a legend, or I'm going to die in 5 years of diabetes.
Like
I really struggle for the middle.
Mate, I'm the same.
I don't really drink.
Yeah.
I don't really drink. Like I might have a glass of wine at dinner.
Yeah.
But because if I drink, I want to get pissed. I don't understand the two beers at the pub at night.
Well, I don't.
Not there's anything wrong with it, but anyone that's doing it and listening.
Yeah.
I don't get a pint after work every night. I don't understand what that brings to my life.
Yeah.
I drink to get pissed or I don't drink.
Yeah.
I take drugs to get high or I don't take drugs.
Yeah.
You know, well, I don't.
It's a purpose, isn't it? There's a reason you have that. You know, if that's alcohol, there's a reason you have that. But the thing is, I found with me, right, you know, this middle road
stuff.
So do
you not have caffeine, by the way?
I do have caffeine.
Okay.
It's my one vice. And you know what? I've said to myself.
I'm just curious because you're drinking turmeric latte.
Turmeric latte. I've had two coffees today and my sleep is valuable. But the thing is, this maybe you relate to that as well. The thing is, for me, it was like me being this sort of, you know, I'll control it. And I've tried it. I'll control the alcohol here. But the thing is, this mega disciplined and all or nothing person over here, if I have one drink here, the damaging effect it does to this over here is quite incredible.
Mm.
I can have one drink and I'll just go, oh, nothing matters. You know, let's just have loads of drinks. You know, it just takes one drink to really damage this over here. And it's...
Is there like a... Do you ever find there's an off switch in you or do you always think that you're always charged up, ready to go?
No, there is an off switch and it's something I've learned more recently.
Because I struggle with that myself, that's what I'm asking.
No, you were.
I'm a driven person.
Yeah.
I'm always a million miles an hour in my brain. Mm. I stay very calm on the surface, but in here it's fucking mental.
Yeah. No, the thing is for me, and I totally understand where you're at, but and a lot of people say, how do you deal with, you know, what do you do to relax? And it's like, well, I've got 6 motorbikes. And they go, well, that's not relaxing. To me, it is, because there's not much you can really think about when you're in control of something like a motorbike. Mm-hmm. You're on point.
You have to be focused.
You know what I mean? If I sit watching TV, relaxing in its most common terms, before you know it, my brain's like, I'm thinking about an argument I had 40 years ago and something I could have said differently.
No, I hear you completely.
Do you know what I mean? Or the laptop's made its way onto my... I'm doing something else. You know, I cannot do that. So, you know, skydiving for me is another one of those things. It's like...
You still skydive?
Yeah, I love it. I haven't been for a few. I need to get back up in the air, but I haven't been for a few years.
I've been meant, you know, you might have seen on my Instagram, I've signed up to do one this year for Dorset Mines.
Yeah.
I've never done one before.
Where are you doing it?
I don't really like flying. I don't really like heights.
Should go well.
So all the things I don't like, that's why I'm doing it. All the things I don't like, I thought I'm going to have to just face these fears.
Yeah.
It's been cancelled 4 times due to wind. Go skydive in Salisbury.
Salisbury.
But yeah, I've moved it now to October 29th. I am petrified, like my palms sweat when I talk about it.
Yeah. It's not a natural thing, is it?
Jumping out of a
plane. You know
what
I mean? It's not, Foxy makes me laugh. He said to me once, like the first time he ever went in a plane, he jumped out of it.
Oh, he'd never flown before.
Fuck it out.
What a nutter. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's like, that is funny. But, you know, it's not a natural thing to do, but the power of actually overcoming that fear. Because it's one of them things. This is how...
Where can I go in my head? Okay, so let me explain what I mean by that.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit on this tiny plane. Mm. I'm a little bit claustrophobic anyway. Yeah. I'm going to sit on this tiny plane with not a lot of room, tied to someone. Mm. That makes me feel a bit nervous anyway. It's one of the reasons I started jiu-jitsu, to get over the claustrophobia. Yeah. Secondly, I'm going to take off in a raggedy old plane, not a double-decker flying to Dubai with fucking beds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's a fear.
Yeah.
And then the fear of jumping out of a plane, the heights element.
Yeah.
But like, every time I sit at home the night before, it's actually annoyed me it's been cancelled 4 times because I'm going through these emotions every night. Yeah. I don't sleep the night before properly. I don't eat properly. Mm. I'm trying to psych myself up. I'm trying to kind of visualize, right, I'm going to go on this plane. I'm going to go up. It's all good. The guys jump all the time. There's, you know, nothing. And if it goes wrong, that's my time to go. Like, I'm trying to accept, you know, like... If it goes wrong, and it goes, cause it's only going to go really wrong.
Yeah.
Then maybe that's meant to be. Maybe that's the way I was meant to go. So I'm trying to like accept
it. Trying to accept.
But I'm still struggling with it, mate. Yeah. Like, I'm still anxious about it, even when I talk now.
Yeah, but the thing is, this is typical of where the problem lies with the majority of people. We're forever worrying about what's going to happen in the future and regretting our past. And what are we missing?
Living in the present.
Yeah. Living in the present. And I know it's easier said than done. Fear is a mental and emotional rehearsal for something you don't want to happen. You know what I mean?
You don't want to happen.
Yeah. So what you're going to... Now, there's two things here. Because you've heard people going like, I've got no fear. Anyone that's got no fear is either dead or they're dying soon. You know what I mean?
Fear's or a robot.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you've got to understand that, you know, you... really have to live in the moment and not start. You are just, the things for me, it's like I throw myself out, done this, that, and the other. And the way I always get that little sense of fear, but you have to be the emotional, observer. Otherwise you become the emotional victim.
Got you.
And that is, you're meant to have fear. Thank God for fear. Tell you what, fear drives you to do a lot of things. Fear of not performing, fear of failure, fear of this, that drives you to do stuff. I was thinking on the way here, God, and your mind goes, oh, don't think about that. And I was thinking about something, I can't even remember what it was, but I thought, oh, that was it. I'm driving a motorbike along and I'm putting my feet on the pegs, you know, not sat on the pegs, extended out.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden I thought about my foot catching and snapping my ankle. And I went, oh, don't think about that.
I do that, exactly.
And then I went, hold on, do think about it because it's going to stop you from doing it again.
Yeah.
And that's just, you know, I thought about that when I came here. But that is exactly it. You know, we've just got to understand that fear and everything is there for a reason. But how much we accept of it in any given situation is for us to tolerate. So we all, you know, at the end of the day, yes, I appreciate there's a certain amount of fear and I've got to appreciate that in this situation, but you can't allow it to consume you.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's, like I say, it's good that it's there. But the thing is, you've got to really just try not to think, you've got to have confidence in the fact that how many people have jumped out of a plane? You've probably got more chance of dying on the roads than you have.
100%.
You have got more chance of dying on the roads. All these things, then confidence in the equipment, everything else, and just understand what you need to understand. The peace that you feel when you actually take that leap is incredible.
That's the surrender piece again, isn't it?
It's the surrender piece, yeah. And it's just incredible, that feeling of nothingness and that just... It's incredible. You need to focus on the benefits of that because otherwise you're going to end up hating it.
Yeah.
And not enjoying it. And just, you know, at the end of the day, just try and
avoid.
It's
over in 3 minutes, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I tell you what, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, you need to like, it's what I used to do, public speaking, I love it now. I used to hate it. But the thing is, you need to focus on the outcome. You need to live that moment where you're on the ground, you're high-fiving, you're feeling that high five. Even whether it's a glass of champagne or something, you feel the bubbles go down your throat. Live the moment afterwards of how joyous that will be, and it will make the moment more acceptable to embrace.
I'll meditate on that.
Easier said than done. But the thing is with you as well, it keeps getting cancelled.
It's a rollercoaster of emotion. It's actually made it worse. Like the first time when I committed to it, you know when you commit to something, you think, fuck it, a bit impulsive, let's do it.
Yeah.
I'm the sort of guy that I need to do it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
If I have time, and a chronic overthinker, if I have time to sit and think, it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
And eat, whatever it is.
This is the problem with this, isn't it? The more we ponder on a situation, the more we will come up with 100 reasons why it could go wrong.
Mm.
And this is why, you know, everything like my business called Breakpoint is about embracing the discomfort at that moment and taking positive action towards doing it.
In a few sentences, Breakpoint, if anyone's listening isn't aware of what it is, what is it?
Breakpoint changes the way you think. It's a disruptive change in habitual behavior in line with a predetermined goal.
Of course.
We've evolved quite a bit. You know, when we first started from the house, then going into the sort of the physical events, we did a lot of public events, which were really using the Special Forces platform, obviously, because that was the thing to do, especially amplified by the TV. So we used the physical events to really get people in, get them to face their fears. 99.9% of people haven't done Special Forces, so it was a very unfamiliar platform.
Maybe we need to have a go.
Yeah. We needed to create that area of vulnerability. And when you're in that vulnerable, you know, when you feel vulnerable and you've got a job to do, you first of all, you bond with the people around you that you don't even know. Secondly, your ego is done a runner. You know what I mean? And this is when you get to know yourself. That's why you see the SAS show and it's like a lot of emotion and everything else, because the emotions are organic, it's raw. And like, you know, it opens up something. And a lot of people in their lives, you know, we spend our lives building a facade of what we want people to believe we are. Mm-hmm. And rarely we, you know, a lot of people, and this is another thing for me that I learned in ayahuasca, I started to understand, I started to like appreciate how much time and effort people, and this is further amplified by social media and people creating a vision of someone they want people to believe they are. Mm-hmm. So much so, they invest so much into that they become the byproduct of that. And then that's the person that, you know, you're looking at some teenagers and stuff like that, that sit in their room crying at night, and, you know, but they've created this perception of what they want everyone else out there to believe. And it's a dangerous place to be there.
It's largely all an illusion, isn't it?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Which is the sad part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk to me about the, is it a Dry January campaign or something you're doing? What's that?
Yeah, no, this is something I'm really excited about. I think this is the first of many events, but I'm passionate about people. You know, I've spoken to people that deal with addictions and, you know, heroin, all kinds of drugs. And every time these people tell me that the worst addiction they see is alcohol, the most damaging addiction is alcohol, you know, and it's, I just know that for me, it was such a massive win for me to conquer alcohol. It changed my life. And not only forget the alcohol, it was the fact that I was allowing something else to be in control of me. And I hated that. I hated that. So once I got the alcohol out of the way, it was like a massive win for me because I knew nothing can control me anymore. Mm-hmm. I want people to feel that change. I want people to experience what it feels like to get that clarity. When I went to film SAS in 2016, first time ever, I went, right, I'm not drinking before we film and I'll have a drink afterwards, because I never believed that I could give up drinking. I did like 8 weeks of no drinking, did the filming, had a great time, had this clarity that was beyond belief. And I can always remember Foxy coming to me at the end and say, right, come on, mate, let's get on it. Let's get smashed. And for the first time in my life, I took a breath. And I went, no. And he went, what? And I said, mate, I just feel brilliant. It was so hard for me to do. But then I walked back to my room when I heard the party going on. And I just, you know, it was hard work, but it was the best thing I ever did. Waking up the next morning, the clarity and everything, the feeling, seeing everyone just absolutely bladdered and still, you know, the morning after, where I'm getting up to go for a run.
No brain fog.
Yeah. It was just incredible. And that was the catalyst for me to start. You know, you can't explain the power and benefit of it. You have to do it to feel that. You know, I can sit here saying, well, it's this, it's that. You have to feel it to believe it. And I think really Dry Jan is something where millions of people are signing up for this. It's growing and growing massively. We're actually working with Alcohol Change. We've got some major sponsors like Liars, who are the drink provider, non-alcoholic drink provider, and a few other sponsors. So we're giving something. Everyone wants something tangible. Do you know what I mean? It's like you want something. This is how we work as humans. We want something tangible at the end of going through a bit of hardship just to qualify that we've done it. So really for us, I'm like, Dry Jan, we need something at the end of that. Something to aim for. So we've come up with a 10K race,
okay,
which we're going to do at Pippingford Park in East Sussex, which is where Breakpoint was first created. Mm-hmm. And it's going to give people training programs. It's going to give mentorship all the way throughout that month. If you don't want to stop drinking, it's just about giving your body a break. It's also alleviating the question in your head that you need to ask yourself, am I addicted to alcohol?
Can I go without it?
Can I go? Because if unless you can go without it, then you are, or you're dependent at least. Mm. Do you know what I mean? So really, ask yourself that question and, you know, sign on.
So if people want to find this, yeah. What was the website?
We've actually got a website link up. We can give you the link.
Okay,
you can put it in the notes.
So yeah. they come on, they sign up and they do a month of no alcohol with some mentoring and some coaching.
Yeah, we've got some big players on board as well. You know, some people that have changed their life through not drinking. So we're going to have some podcasts. We're going to have we're building an amazing community. Mm. You know, at the end of that 10K race, it's not like other 10K races where it's, right, get your medal and fuck off or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, at the end, you know, there's going to be, we're getting the community together. We're going to have talks. It's going to be amazing. So it's a really great event. And, we're looking at, to continue this through the year. There's actually Dry July as well. I don't know if you've heard of that one.
It's not heard of that one yet.
Australian thing, yeah.
No, I've heard of Stoptober.
Sober October. Yeah. So, you know, I think it's really, some people at the end of that journey will go, I want to keep on going.
Yeah. Most people actually do.
Yeah.
Most people that I see in our gym environment that have started some form of diet or sugar cut or something just to kind of get themselves back on track, when they get to the end, they're like, I actually can live like this.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what I've not been, and just carry on.
Yeah.
I'll have a look at that. But yeah. That sounds.
But if nothing else, you know, at the end of the day, it's
not that I drink, but I'll do the mentoring and then the run at the end.
No, it's good just to get everyone together.
It's interesting because I don't know the stats. It'd be interesting to find out. I might have to Google it after this. But I feel like the new generation, I know that the younger generation are some of the least drinking generation ever.
Yeah.
And I know that because I own and operate nightclubs and promotions and nights and festivals.
I've heard this.
So a lot of the freshers that are coming now.
Yeah.
I had a meeting with one of the guys quite high up at the Bournemouth Uni, and you know, we were talking about how the nighttime economy's changed and blah, blah, blah. He was like, mate, I feel for you. And I said, why? He said, because our nightclub Halo, the church one, is predominantly 18 to 25.
Yeah.
He says, I feel for you. He said, because when I speak to the freshers this year and say, what did you get up to at the weekend? They used to say something along the lines of, we went to Halo, went to Cameo, went to the old fire station, got in a ket hole, got fucked, got smashed, had a 3-day session in my mate's kitchen.
Yeah.
He said, now when I asked them, what are you doing? They said, we went for a hike over the Dorset coastline, had a barbecue and had a non-alcoholic gin. He said, like, can you imagine? These are 18-year-old freshers.
Wow, that is great to hear.
Like, so, you know, commercially for me, it's terrible.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
However, as someone that actively promotes like well-being and living well and kind of life, I'm buzzing.
Mm.
I'm buzzing that the new generation aren't as dependent on a product to have fun.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Like I can go to a party. I can go to a rave sober and have as much fun as my mates off their head.
Yeah. Great way
to I always thought I was weird, but as I got older, it's actually
I believe I could.
Yeah.
I believe I could.
Just be silly. Like, kind of be yourself.
I'll find that easy.
Mate, there's something I wanted to ask you here.
Yeah.
Within the military kind of bit stuff, we've touched on a load of it anyway, but there's something here that says, like, you help train operatives to identify child prostitutes and rescue them.
That wasn't part of the military.
What is that? That's
basically, when I went to Southeast Asia, like, I came out, this was a big, another main event in my life. And I came back, I finished as a contractor over in Iraq because I came out of the
military.
When
you say contractor, that sounds to me private.
That's private contractor.
So you'd finished the military, you've come out, then you went back over as like a mercenary.
Yeah. Yeah,
sick.
I went back for four.
Sounds fun.
4.5 years. Mate, it was a massive, it was mental. That was crazy. That was the craziest part. That's the craziest part of my career.
What, just because there's less red tape?
Yeah, it's like, well, mate, less red tape and just the wild west of a war zone when it's in its young years, you know what I mean? Now it's quite, you know, it's, but when it's in that young sort of stage, you know, it's like you see the power of countries that make out, oh, this war, this is costing this country so much a day. They are making 3 times that amount.
I can imagine.
Do you know what I mean? They are making so much money.
They wouldn't carry on if it wasn't making money.
No, absolutely not.
Everything's commercial. You
know, the whole thing, the shares market and everything.
They are
milking it. We, you know, there's pallets of $1 million coming in. They were flooding the country with money. You know, it was just mayhem. Like, we had Saddam Hussein's villas. We actually had his cars.
Yeah.
We were renting them out. We had a high car company, armored Mercedes, but they were all Saddam's old cars. It was the Wild West. But the thing for me is, like, I got attacked when I was first there, and it was the most scariest fucking experience ever in my life. And the reason I say that, look, when I was in the SBS, and I'm quite happy to say this, it wasn't majorly eventful. You know, from an outsider looking in, it was eventful. But, you know, within the military circles and compared to your Afghans and everything today, there wasn't a lot going on. Mm. There's a big reason for why I left. You know what I mean? I wanted to be at war every day and there wasn't enough of it. So when I came out, it's like, and I went over to Iraq, I said I was never going back to a war zone. 3 months later, I end up in a war zone. And it was the cash. You know, I earned more in Iraq as a contractor in 2 months than I earned a whole year in the special forces.
Private, yeah.
It was incredible. And that first time I got attacked, it was like the most horrible experience in my life.
Attacked in what sense?
Well, we were driving a car at 130 Ks down the highway. I was protecting three cars in front of me, and the militia, two cars full of gunmen, attackers at 130 Ks an hour.
Fuck.
And it was a shootout, and it was like, but this is my fucking, this is like an incredible story. Because for me, like, it was around the time that the statue came down at Ferdow Square. Mm-hmm. You know, the Americans had liberated or invaded. They don't know the difference.
Yeah.
and, you know, in the papers, oh, Iraq was safe and da-da-da-da. Yeah, the Team America had moved in. It was great. We knew on the ground that it was a whole different story. This was the calm before the storm, as we now know. Mm-hmm. But for us, you know, as a contractor, you don't make a company money. You allow them to operate in hostile environments. And your value is only appreciated when it's tested. Now, I was head of ABC News security team, and they were looking to downsize. And I was like, oh shit. Not only was I, for the first time ever, earning massive amounts of money, but I also knew that if they downsized, there would be consequences. So for me, I was like, I wanted to go and pick up. There was a whole changeover of the staff and everything in the ABC bureau chief. And I knew the new guy coming in was going to downsize security. And I was like, I need to be the person that looks him in the eyes and says to him, you're making a big mistake. So I put myself on the job. I went with one other, you know, two lads. This is the whole contracting world. Two lads bringing in 12 people. It's the wrong way around.
Yeah, completely.
Completely wrong
Even
way around.
Even as a civilian. Like,
I know exactly. That. You don't need to be a military strategist to understand that's wrong. But the cash was in control, wasn't it? And so we took the job on. And anyway, the day before, I'm sitting there going, what are the words? When I look this guy in the eye, what are those words, please? You know what I mean? Especially when there's cash involved. It's like, yeah, I know your motive, mate. So I was like thinking, and nothing cut it. And so 14 hours on the road, driving the day before to go and pick him up, I had a long time to think. And I was actually driving through Mardi and Fallujah on the highway going out to Jordan. And I started visualizing. This is where the whole visualizing thing, this is where my spiritual click came in. I started visualizing about all the things that could happen to justify our existence. So I'm thinking, right, Ramadi and Fallujah is still a hot spot. We're coming back down here tomorrow. And I'm going through this attack. Mm-hmm. We're getting attacked by the militia. There's a massive gunfight. And I'm living the moment. I've always been able to be that creative type. You know, I live the moment. I could smell the cordite from the bullets as they're going down. I could hear the noises. I could taste it in my spit. And I'm going through it time and time again and then thinking, yeah, it'd be great. We'd get everyone out. We'd get back to Baghdad. Da, 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 da. So I went time and time and time again, visualized this thing like I was there. Anyway, got to Jordan, picked up the people. Next day, I'm coming back down that road. I'm driving the car. Head hits the steering wheel. I'm that tired. I wake up. And then all of a sudden, I look in the rearview mirror as I'm passing Ramadi and Fallujah. And that attack happened. Exactly. I mean everything. It was like deja vu on steroids. The location, the timings, everything happened that I'd revised the day before. Not only that, I'd also said to my number two when we sat there in the bar that night, when we get back to Baghdad, there's going to be a massive hero's welcome. The doors are going to fly open. There's going to be champagne flowing. We're going to sign the contract for another couple of years. The attack happened, everything, and we got out of it. There's eight militia and two of us. Kept all the 12 people. Got out of the situation. Their car didn't do so well. And I'm like, my head's spinning out after the attack. You know, we'd blown our windows out, shooting through the windows. So 140K winds coming through. Our ears are screaming because of no ear protection and all the loud bangs and everything else. And my head's spinning out thinking, that's the second time I've done that.
You got to stop thinking, mate.
I know. Well, there's a method in the madness here. Anyway, get to Baghdad. I'd like manage to just get over it. The doors scream open. Heroes welcome. I pull up the car, open the door. All the bullets are falling out of the car. All the glasses falling out of the car on the floor. And I'm like, I look up, glass of champagne.
No way.
Glass of champagne. Bang. I taste the bubbles exactly like I'd experienced. And then we got called into the ABC Bureau's chief's office. So I thought anything can happen here because you can't go. You know what I mean? It's not the Wild West in that respect. Mate, he thrust his hand out. Your action saved our lives today. Thank you so, so much. Contract.
No way.
Fact. And that...
That's fucking crazy.
That is why. And although I didn't do anything about it at that time, that set me thinking, oh my God, was it coincidence? Maybe even if it was coincidence, right? It set me on that path to understand that the power of visualization, power of positive thought really does have some merit. Everyone's doing it negatively and getting the negative outcomes. Start thinking the other way.
Wow.
So that was incredible. Thing is, Ty, with the experiences in life, you know, a lot of people, like I think constantly, and I think about, you know, I'm always, every day is a school day. I'll never suss it out. And I never want to. I find it so empowering to really understand who we are.
Mm.
And develop and evolve. And when people have a bad situation, their mentality is, oh, I just want to forget that. I just want to push that as far away as possible and not, I don't want to, you know, that could be a bad relationship. It could be a bad something. But these are the moments we need to embrace because this is where we learn.
Mm.
You know what I mean? And I've had some really profound things that have happened only because I'm choosing to remember and analyze them. Everyone's had them. But are they choosing to think what happened in that moment? So the next time you meet something happens where your brain would usually go, that's weird or that's a coincidence. Sit and think. Sometimes you might not connect the dots, but sometimes you might go, wow.
There's a few things, as you've said, that's been happening in my life at the moment that...
Yeah.
It's just triggered me to think about it and think, fucking hell.
But I really think until you get yourself grounded, you know, if you're sat there whacking processed food down your gut every 5 minutes, drinking alcohol, smoking, this, that, and the other, you're never going to have the stable foundation where the things start to line up in front of you. You've got to line yourself up first. Coming back to that whole science piece.
Yeah, yeah.
This is really interesting because people don't understand, right? You know, the technology, everyone knows how a phone works.
Yep.
But you ask them how their operating system works. They haven't got a clue, have they? But really, how does a phone work? A phone works by tapping into a frequency, and it taps into this very same frequency that's on the other phone, maybe over the other side of the world. We're no different. That phone is a representation of how we are organically tapped into that frequency. Everything in this world vibrates at different states, like this table, everything's vibrating, and that creates a frequency. In that frequency is information. Now, when two equal wavelengths meet, it doubles.
Okay.
The power of it doubles.
Yep.
So that really means, you know, we are frequency, we talk, and when two people of the same frequency are talking and communicating, the energy doubles. So we pass that energy across. That's why you feel good when you like talk to people. You get a room of positive people. The energy is incredible.
It is incredible.
That's why.
And it doesn't lie.
No, it doesn't lie. And you can walk into a room and go, you know what? I felt the energy was really bad. You know what I mean? You've got someone who's really low. So people can steal that energy because they're a real low vibration. People can lift other people up, but it's just something that you should really appreciate. If you want to go further down the rabbit hole on that, they came up with the Spain scale of emotion, where they put 25,000 people into a room and they were able to measure the frequency of different emotions.
Yeah.
Right? Joy, pain, all these different emotions. What do you think was the most powerful frequency that the human body was giving off?
Love.
400 times stronger than love was authenticity.
Wow.
So what you say and what you do and what you believe is more powerful than anything.
That's really interesting.
And I really wish people would start to understand this because I'm tapping into all this stuff now with Bruce Lipton, with Joe Dispenza. This is the true source code of who we are.
Mm.
Not these lumps of meat and gravy that just, you know what I mean?
The funny thing is a lot of people
know it and feel it, but I don't understand what they're feeling.
Yeah.
So that thing you just said, you know, when you walk into a room,
yeah,
like I feel tension in a room very well because I've been in the nightclub industry for 15 years. So when I walk into a room straight away, whether it's my club or not, I'm like, it's going to kick off over there. And someone's like, hello, do you know? I said, trust me, the next 3 minutes can kick off.
Yeah.
There's an energy in the room.
Yeah.
A lot of people feel that energy, but they don't understand it.
No,
you're kind of like learning about it, aren't you? Understand what it means.
I mean, there's so much you can learn, but it's
funny because I had a guy on a podcast called Joe. You might have seen him, all the tattoos.
Yes.
The conspiracy theorist guy that everyone was calling him.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because what you've said is like a toned down version of what he was saying. He was saying that we're holographic frequency beings and, you know, everything's energy and everything's... Obviously, he took it to a point where a lot of people kind of lost the trail and thought he was going a bit over the top.
Yeah.
But you're saying it a bit more like this SBS thing you said about, you know, spirituality backed by science.
Mm.
You're saying it in a mode I think a lot of people could relate to.
And that's what you have to do, mate.
Yeah.
You know, you can't take people from here and deliver that and expect you're going to get buy-in. You know, at the end of the day, I did relate to a lot of the
of course.
A lot of it. I can't, you know, the human mind can't embrace a lot of that stuff. Mm. But really, it's just, you know what? I wish people would do this. And this is what we're losing in this society as well at the moment, in this day and age. It's getting worse and worse and worse. And that's freedom of speech. And just like, if someone wants to say that stuff, right, and they believe it, I'm going to appreciate that.
I watched a podcast on the plane back from Mallorca with Stephen Bartlett and Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Mm.
And he said that he thinks it's bizarre that he can, it's an opinion that he puts out on Twitter and he gets attacked for it.
Yeah.
It's his opinion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like he's not, just what he thinks of something.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what you just said
there.
It's
just crazy. You know, at the end of the day, if you've got your opinion, you believe in it, means something to you, then fine. And you're not using it aggressively to attack someone else.
I say this about religion, right? I have a lot of friends that say have been to jail and then they come out Muslim or they come out Christian or they come out as monks because they're meditating loads or they're spiritual or whatever. I'm not a religious guy. I've never really labeled, I don't like the labeling thing because I think it divides.
Yeah.
So I believe there's a greater being, a greater power. There's something in the universe, a greater energy.
Yeah.
I just don't want to call it God or Allah or Buddha or anything. I always say, if that person needs that faith for them to be a good human in a community, I'm all for it.
Yeah.
This particular person I'm talking about, he's come out of jail. He's turned to religion and he lives the most peaceful life now ever. I don't agree with the religion. I don't agree with most of the things religion stands for. I don't agree with the division of it. I don't agree with loads of things. But without that faith, he's a shithouse in the community.
Yeah.
With the faith, he's amazing. So that's a positive.
Exactly. It doesn't matter what catalyst. If that creates you being a great person and it gives you a sense of purpose and direction, go for it.
Go for it. Don't push it on others. Don't this is a mandating thing I struggle with. With anything.
Yeah. See, I just think...
The choice.
When it comes to religion, a lot of people, you know, I've really started like studying bits of religion, this, that, the Hidden Gospel of Thomas. Have you heard about that?
No, I'm not. I'll Google
scriptures.
It. Yeah.
I think a lot of it, it's like, especially the Bible has been so distorted and it doesn't want us to understand, you know, it's made it very external and physical, like God was, you know, I grew up believing like...
God was a man.
Yeah, and he had, you know, a baby in the main, you know, all that.
Yeah, I remember all that. Yeah, I went to Sunday school growing up.
You know
I mean?
It's just like, it's such a, you know, and the Virgin Mary, how did that happen? You know, it's like, it's you know, I think it's been so distorted. Now, the way I look at it, right, I came up with this and I'm quite proud of it. But to me, are you religious? I believe there is something. We're all a part of something bigger. There is something else there. There's an energy field.
I agree.
And God means to me, once you tap into that energy field, it's guidance on demand.
Wow. Okay. I'm just thinking what Joe, he referenced it as well. God, he gave it as an analogy or something, but he used it about kind of being born, living and dying. That was his thing of God. It's an anagram, he said.
Yeah.
But your one's quite good actually as well. Yeah, I've not heard that before.
Once you tap in and you understand the true source of creation and energy and everything, that is you are guided and it's guidance on demand.
Like that.
And for me, it's like, you know, everything requires discipline. I'd look at that as well. It's like, that to me is the disciple within.
Mm-hmm. So you're doing very similar. Yeah. So you're trying to relate it to your life in a way that you can identify with it and you can engage with it.
Yeah. But also, the language has been distorted. Our language has been distorted.
All of those books, right? Mm. Whether it's the Quran, the Bible, all of those. If you think... You and I are recording this podcast right now, right? Because of modern technology.
Yeah.
So in 100 years,
what you said on this podcast will never get distorted because they're going to fucking listen to it.
Yeah.
Now, take us back 4,000, 8,000, 12,000, depends if you're Graham Hancock or who you are, how old the world is.
Mm.
Someone's got a story. There's no pen and paper to write.
Yeah.
Then someone has to memorize that story through generations and generations and generations until someone's then got a pen. Then they write the first copy of it. Fuck me, is that Chinese whispers or what? Like, you know, was it a donkey or was it a cow? Was it a whale or was it a bird? Was it, you know what I mean?
No,
was it a boy or was it a girl?
And here's another interesting fact as well. The stories we tell are 50% embellished.
Yeah.
And every time you tell a story, you're not telling a story from the original event. You're telling a story of your last known memory.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of this stuff. So you imagine that over time.
Hundreds of years, hundreds of people. And remember at school when you did the Chinese whispers? Like, Ollie's gay, pass it on. Do you remember? Like, by the time it got back round, it was someone else is something else.
Yeah, yeah.
Between 20 kids.
Exactly, exactly.
Before we finish, Ollie, the child prostitute thing. What was that, the story with the children?
Oh, sorry, because you did ask that. Can I see how I get distracted? So anyway, after that, I came out of that and I was like, I needed to get out of Iraq because that caused me that. After that attack, it was like, I thought I was never going to leave. Problems with alcohol, Valium, everything, getting shot out. It's not the best for your mental health. Took me a while to do anything about it. I was living in Australia at the time. Plucked the courage to get out of there, go over to Australia, property. This was my focus, you know, stability. Then I heard about something that really grabbed my attention. And that was an organization called the Grey Man going into Southeast Asia, rescuing kids from child prostitution, slavery, and everything else.
Wow.
1.6 million kids a year sold into that industry in Southeast Asia alone. And here's the thing, by their families.
You're kidding.
Mm-mm. By their families. Now,
when you say children, what age are we talking?
Well, anything from like four upwards, any kind of age. Human trafficking, it's like, it's the most profitable business. It's bigger than drugs.
Hmm.
And when I heard that, the same effect on me as I just saw in you. Mm. And I was like, I can't comprehend that.
No.
You like think of your grandma or someone like that or someone you really love or blah, 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 selling you into the skin trade. And like, you know, like kids, brothels, sweatshops, or onto a fishing village. That was a one-way trip. They were used and abused and then thrown over the side. You know, they never came back. So as soon as I heard that, I was like, I'm going. I'm going to go and I'll have some kind of effect in changing the destiny of these kids' lives. Mm. And we went over there. We had a four-man team. First of all, we were going into all the clubs in Thailand and we're, you know, undercover cameras and we're trying to find underage kids being in brothels and stuff. They're all being tipped off. We were working with, you know, local police. And I can remember we were doing a briefing the night, you know, before we were about to go in and do a bust. And like, I can always remember, like, we did this briefing. These are the people we've seen. And we had all the briefing, you know, like the military, we had all the briefing stuff up. And I saw one guy from the local police who was on the bust get his phone out and go, ksh, of all the pictures we had. And I looked at it, I went, this is fucked.
Corrupt.
This fucking ain't going to go in. Next day, we went in and did the bust. Oh, no problem here. All the staff had changed everything. And I was like, nah. So anyway, after that, I was like, this ain't going to work. I then went into the foothills in Thailand, up near the border, the Thai border. And I went with a guy called Mickey Chu Sia, who was part of Khosa, Children of Southeast Asia. And that was an orphanage.
Mm-hmm.
And basically went to find the kids who were held in satellite camps all across the border. And we went and identified these camps and we got one particular one and there was 22 kids there, which is a lot in the whole scheme of things.
Being held ready to sell?
Yeah, basically the cartels would come up, they would recruit them. It's like a recruitment process. They'd come up, say, fishing village, brothel, sweatshop.
Fuck, yeah.
So they'd come up, do that, and then they'd go away and then they'd come and collect them and take off. So it was our job to get in there, intercept these kids either before the cartels got there or afterwards. And we were having such amazing success. It was incredible. And there's one particular bus that the picture of went back to our HQ in Australia. They were so proud of what we were doing. They give it to the newspapers. And that went viral all over the world. And before you know it, international incident, Thai government, total in defense, saying nothing like that's going on in our country. These guys are a load of crooks putting the money in their pockets from donations. But don't worry, we're going to arrest them. we're still in country, and I'm like, we're still doing other operations. And I'm like, I get a message on my phone saying, get out now, get out. You've got to get out now. And we managed to escape across the border, managed to get an airport, and then bang, I managed to get back to Australia. And that is where I crashed and burned. And that is when I started, you know, I went on a path of self-destruction. Wow. But the thing that happened for me, I look at the value of everything. I always look at the value. The amazing thing that happened to me in that moment was the first time I did that and realized, this is me. This is my true purpose. I couldn't have done that without taking the detour in the special forces. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have done it. Get me the skills and everything to be able to do that job and be selected to do that job. It taught me firsthand the power of helping other people and the value. And as a society, are losing that. We're losing the value. Even in a close-knit sports, you know, like a high Premier League team, in a corporate structure, people are vying for position and they're prepared to step up on top of each other to get there. You know, I teach a lot in my talks about collaboration over competition. You know, the real true meaning, and this is where our language has been distorted to mean something else. You know, the true meaning of the word competition, to strive together.
I love that.
But we've been taught that we must beat the other person. Two people win when you strive together. Say this one's got the competitive advantage because they've got the experience. They're playing someone less experienced. This person wins, and that's great, but this person learns every time. Mm-hmm. And that's how we collaborate and strive together. Competition is striving together, not beating other people. And you look at the schooling system and everything, it's made as extremely singular. Mm-hmm. It's not about teamwork. It's coming
the
first.
The community element is going, isn't
it? Yeah, no, it's coming first in your exams, beating someone on the playing field. Everything's about competition. Collaborate over compete.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Also heartbreaking about the kids, mate. Mad that yeah, that no,
it was a shame. I mean, it all came crashing down. I thought I'd be doing that for the rest of my life, and it came crashing down. But, you know, at the end, I'll never forget, you know, the kids that we rescued, seeing them in the school uniform with a satchel going down the street, smiling, laughing.
Beautiful.
And we skim the surface. It's a massive problem.
Winds me up, that kind of stuff.
Me too.
What's next for you, Ollie?
Lots of stuff, mate. I mean, I'm with SAS Australia now.
Yes.
With Ant.
Yes. I saw a few bloopers and funny clips when he was here a couple of weeks ago.
No, it
looks really good.
It's great. And we've got an amazing team. Amazing team now. We've got like me, Ant, the OGs.
Yeah.
Me, Ant, and Jay Staz. Jay and Staz. And the laugh we had from him. It was great. And, you know, we're messaging each other all the time. When can we get back?
Has it been commissioned for season 2 yet?
I'm 4 in with SAS Australia.
Oh, right.
Yeah, this happened. Oh. After I got offloaded years ago.
I thought it was the first.
It's the first with the new team.
Got you.
But I think this is a team that's going to stick now. But yeah, it shows in October and then, you know, it providing it gets the stats, then we'll do another one. But I can't see how it wouldn't. It's one of the most popular TV shows over there. So
it's still in its infant stage over there.
Yeah. But the thing is, I mean, I always say this as well, you know, when I was in that house, you know, I got given the gift of TV, but I can never get distracted from what my mission is. And that mission is Breakpoint. Breakpoint is a globally identified brand recognized for the positive growth and development of others. That will never, ever get diluted again. You know, when I say again, I've tried loads of different things, but that is where I'm at. So Breakpoint now is now evolved into the fact that we deliver corporate only programs, and we've got a virtual platform. You can't change people in an hour by talking to them in a, you know, like a motivational talk. You can't change them in 2 days, whatever. That growth needs to be continuous. You know, it's like for me, I'm growing every day. And I'm also failing I'm failing. And I'll keep on failing for the rest of my life because I know my goals are big enough. You know, I'm not going to sit there faking perfection on egogram.
Yeah.
You know, and that really for me is like Breakpoint is my mission. I've got another couple of documentaries and stuff like that, but I never set out to be a celebrity. I'm not even keen on the word. Mm-hmm. You know, my mission is to change humanity as much, and it's a big job.
It's an incredible endeavor, mate.
Yeah.
Something I'd like to do in the future.
And Everest. Sorry, I should mention
Everest.
I'm doing Everest next year. Yeah.
Are you?
2024, yeah. I did Amadablam 2022.
Who with? Anyone
Nims.
We know?
Nims, are you? Yeah. So I'm doing, I'll be on the Everest trip in April.
That's so cool.
Yeah. But the thing is, Ty, this is one thing I'll say. There's so many people, and this is what a lot of people do. They are still gobbing off about a benchmark of the past. What are you doing now?
Yeah.
You know, what are you doing right now? What's in your sights for the future? You know what I mean? And this, I'm a true believer. Create a story you'd love to be told, and that never ends.
Yeah. Good note to finish on, mate. Mm. Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Cheers, brother.
That was awesome.
Thanks for listening. Hope you guys enjoyed the show. Please remember to subscribe on your favourite platform and follow the journey on social media.